Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 456th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Fallon. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And continuing our mask theme from our last podcast, we have with us the lead author, Nick. Nick, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm still here. Nick, pharmacist in Montreal, professor at the Faculty of Pharmacy at the University of Montreal, and a member of the peer group.
Yeah. And so if you listened to the last podcast, we talked about the evidence for using the using masks in healthcare workers. And we looked at it was a total of five trials. And we showed that if you're looking at the risk of flu-like illness for the person wearing the mask, not in preventing other people from getting it, there was a 1% difference, 4.5% down to 3.6% for surgical masks versus N95 masks. And then for cloth masks versus surgical masks, it was about a 2% difference, going from about 2.5% for cloth masks down to about 0.5% for surgical masks. And that was the best available evidence that we had for healthcare workers. Now, what we have not covered previously is what about the masks for the general public? And, you know, given that we are all parts, all members, I guess, of the general public, this is probably of more interest and certainly is more of an important topic when it comes to COVID.
Right. And James, I'll just clarify with your numbers that you gave. Those are absolute numbers. And if we assume the relative benefit stays similar, that as the baseline numbers go up, the event rates would go up and so would the differences. But we don't know that for sure. But that's what we think in science-y language happens. So we hope that happens. But don't forget, these were done in studies of influenza, and it's driven by influenza rates, which were low during most of these studies. Yeah. So that is a challenge for the research. But that continues on for this as well. The number of people who are actually sick makes it hard to show statistical significance because the event rates are low. It's the same reason that clinical trials of primary prevention in cardiovascular disease have thousands and thousands of people, because the event rates are low. So you need a lot of people to show a difference. So let's talk about the outcomes related and the events related to using masks in a community. And there are, I think, 11 RCTs, are there not, Nick?
Yeah, so maybe just a little context. So what we're going to talk about comes from a publication we had in the Canadian Family Physician in July. So as we mentioned previously in the other podcast, we decided to do our own systematic review because we weren't really happy with what we found. We found 12 RCTs looking at the efficacy of masks in the community, basically. None of it, again, I think it's important to remind people that none of it actually is related to COVID-19. Yeah. There are some actually ongoing right now, but at the best of my knowledge, none of it is actually published yet.
Yeah, I don't think so, Nick. We looked at that just recently and none of them had come out yet. But they are, I mean, there are some underway and those will be interesting. And it'll be interesting if they can capture that piece about not just the individuals wearing the mask, but in the public in general. Does wearing masks help prevent the transmission for other people other than those wearing masks? Nick, what we did is we broke these studies. Why we weren't happy is they were pooling too many studies that are different together. So why don't you take us through the different groups that we saw? Because I think the putting them in their proper groups is something that hasn't been done up to the point where we did our study.
No, you're right. So yeah, that was the main problem, I guess. So we had trials looking at very, very different stuff. So we had trials looking at the use of masks, like for every person in a certain group or community. Let's say, for example, we got trials for university students. Then we had trials looking at the use of masks by sick people once they got a diagnosis, which probably sounds weird, right? But anyway, some trials looking at the use of masks by healthy people living with someone who got a diagnosis of viral infection after, obviously, they got the diagnosis. And then some trials looking at the use of masks by every member of an household once someone in the family got sick. So it's like a big melting pot of very different stuff.
And there was one about using them in tent communities for attending a Hajj, right? Like a pilgrimage. So it's a real, as you say, it's a quite a mix of different groups and communities wearing masks.
Yeah. And what's surprising to me is like previous systematic reviews were actually able to combine all of them together and give us a number.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, to me, when people, you're sending someone home who's already been sick for, in some of the studies, 3 days, they've been transmitting it for at least those 3 days and probably earlier, and expecting there to be a difference now, it's the cat was so far out of the bag. It's not, I was surprised, and they were the majority of the studies.
And of course, another problem with that is obviously people were not wearing masks 24/7, right?
Yes.
So they were actually living together, but they were told to wear a mask, well, depending on the trial, let's say, when they were in the same room.
Right.
But not while they were eating, obviously.
So it's very tricky. So I think we'll put links to all of these tools that we've developed or that you can have a look at. And I think the way we broke it down was we tried to compare oranges to oranges and apples to apples as much as possible. And I think, so the very first, or probably the more useful one is, there is a little bit of evidence. If you wear a surgical mask while out in public, does it protect the individual from a flu-like illness? And what do they find with that, Nick?
So I think I'd start with the rest of the trials so we can just clear them out.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be pretty quick. So we had, 8 or 9 of our trials that were looking at sick people in the house or healthy people with someone sick in the house and blah, blah, blah. And in the end, it didn't show anything.
Mm-hmm.
Which is probably not very surprising.
Yeah, and it's not that the numbers were there were in some cases thousands of people in these clinical trials in total.
Yeah,
and so if there was something going on, they'd have picked it up. So it's not, we don't know whether it was they didn't use the masks properly. We don't know whether it was because the people were sick to begin with. We don't know if it was because they only limited it to when they're in certain rooms or all of that sort of stuff. But none of these trials are able to show a reduction in the risk of getting a flu-like illness or confirmed influenza.
So, yeah, exactly.
And that was, 4, 5, 6, 7 of the trials. Now, there was some other trials in other areas that at least give some evidence of benefit.
Yeah, so I think the two trials we have that are the most relevant to the situation right now with COVID-19 are actually two almost identical trials. They're both published by the same group. And they're both conducted in the University of Michigan in 2010 and 2012. So what these guys did, actually, they randomized residence halls in the university. And they told students in the mask group to wear a mask as much as possible. In one of the trials, they asked specifically for at least 6 hours a day. And they just looked at different things. So like you said, confirmed influenza, influenza-like illness. These were done for 6 weeks, obviously during the influenza season. And yeah, we did see a difference. I don't know, Mike, do you want to maybe just talk about a bit how we combine these? Because in previous systematic reviews, they tried and they showed no difference, actually.
Right.
And
Yeah, so they came close in the other ones, but they didn't quite reach statistical significance. And what we did is, and we do this for all of our meta-analysis, we go back to baseline numbers. So these are cluster designs, so we can't truly go back to the pure baseline numbers. What we have to do is go back to their baseline numbers, adjust for clustering, and then use those. We didn't include any of the adjustments done for multiple analysis, et cetera, within the clinical trial. So we just focused on precisely what the numbers were. And I think that's a little bit different too in ours. We were very careful about that level of analysis, keeping it consistent across all of our comparisons.
Yeah. Yeah. So in these trials, we found no difference in confirmed influenza cases, but again, numbers were just very, very low. So they got like a little over 30 cases out of 1,600 people. So obviously
it's too small.
Yeah, yeah. When we looked at flu-like illness or influenza-like illness, we did find a difference. There was actually a 25% risk in the control group and a 21% risk in the mass group, so an absolute difference of 4% and an NNT of 24.
And that's over a period of around 6 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so it's interesting to me, some of the conversations I've heard about this is people going, you're telling everyone they barely worked. And when I went into this, and we didn't obviously know what we were going to find, I assumed we'd find nothing or a smaller difference. And when we found a 4% absolute reduction, I was thinking, for a single intervention that's inconsistently used and all of that stuff, I thought 4% was quite dramatic.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But others are saying things like, so you're telling us they don't work. And it's all context, right? Because I have seen all the other systematic reviews and everything. And I was thinking about all of the things that we do to prevent illness, like washing our hands, avoiding each other, all of that stuff, coughing into our elbows, you name it. And this being that one thing that made a 17% relative difference and a 4% absolute difference. Like, to me, that was bigger than I had anticipated, particularly when in the trial they acknowledged people didn't wear their masks as much as they hoped.
No, exactly. So they asked, in the second trial, they asked students to wear the mask at least 6 hours a day. And actually, when you look at the time people were actually wearing a mask, it was between 4 and 5 hours a day on average.
Yeah.
So yeah, I feel like some people actually expect like masks to work like 100%.
I know. It's remarkable to me. They expect just one thing that just covers your mouth to work as good as hand washing and gloves and avoiding each other and being careful when you're sick to quarantine, all of that stuff. They think that somehow just is a panacea for prevention, where of course it can't be. But that the fact that we even, like, I was thinking when we published this, people would be like, wow, they work like dynamite. Well, we heard this. Oh, that's so disappointing. So it's all perspective. Dave, you're the most negative person, I think, on the planet. So what do you think?
Well, that is based on RCTs too. So what I want to do is put this all into context, because I think you're right. I think, as they always say, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And, you know, there is a belief, you know, that if you're walking around with a mask, you're protected. And that just is not going to be it couldn't be true for so many reasons. And I think a lot of it comes from we're always showing absolute numbers, and so if you would do the relative number on that, it's about a 20% reduction roughly in the risk of getting a flu-like illness, which is for a very inexpensive, relatively non-toxic, other than it can be irritating, and a lot, some people don't like wearing them, or I don't think anybody likes wearing them, but they can be somewhat uncomfortable for people, and certainly it's difficult to have children and other people have disabilities that makes it impossible for them to wear them. But in the context of it is that when we look at a number of the publications, and there's been a few of them recently, one just recently in Lancet, looking at all of the different things that you can do to try and reduce your risk of viral infections. And when they look at the cohort data, they're suggesting that you're seeing 40% relative reductions, 70% relative reductions in viral illnesses when you look at cohort data. But we've talked about probably for 455 podcasts some of the issues with cohort data. So it is very tricky. And in fact, it may be as effective as that. The RCTs don't show that, but they're also looking at different aspects of how we use masks. And so there's so much comparing apples to oranges here that it makes it very, very difficult to really put it into a proper context. And I would like to remind people, though, of when the authors of these systematic reviews that are primarily looking at cohort data, they give you a number, let's say it's 40%, 70%, whatever it is. It sounds impressive, and if that number is real, it is fairly impressive relative numbers. But they always say it's with low certainty because of all of the problems associated with the studies that are being done. It's really tricky to do cohort trials and get really good information. So, and in fact, the very last comment on one of these reviews was that robust RCTs are needed to better inform the evidence for these interventions. So, it is true. tricky. And so we've now talked about that. That I don't think there's any other evidence that we could find for RCTs in the general public. So then I guess the question comes up to, what do you do with this? And, you know, evidence is not just RCTs. It's not just cohorts. You know, practicing in an evidence-based way is looking at the best available evidence, but also using, you know, clinical judgment and sort of values and preferences. And I think we can mix all that in to make reasonable decisions. I don't know what you guys think.
I actually don't know how it is right now in BC for you guys. Mm-hmm. In Quebec, it's weird or interesting or scary. I don't know. We got, like in the States, we got recently a few people getting out in the street, because we got to wear a mask right now. Mm-hmm. When we go in public places. Do you need to?
No.
Okay. So we got to do it now. And obviously some people are screaming at their rights and liberties and that mm-hmm. kind of stuff.
It's an interesting discussion. I think one of the best sort of analogies is, you know, it would be... I certainly wouldn't want my surgeon to go, you know what? It's my right to not wear a mask. You know that, and I think that's a great example. It's not a rights issue. You know, it's everyone trying to do the best thing. I think there is a suggestion that whether you look at cohort data or RCT data, wearing a face mask does reduce transmission of viral infections. We don't know the true magnitude of it, but it appears to work or have an effect. And I can tell you right now, if the effect was 20% or 70%, I don't think that should change what we would do or what we should do, if that makes any sense. You know, but where the discussion now comes in is, it's all about baseline risk. It's like, you know, should everybody be on a statin? Well, it's not a yes or no answer. It's looking at what is the chance of getting an infection. Now, the chance of any of us getting COVID is still relatively very small. And so you cannot reduce a very, very relatively small risk by much from an absolute perspective. But I think there are so many questions that we don't have answers to. We don't know. The studies that looked at it are people preventing themselves from getting infections. To best of my knowledge, I don't think there's any RCTs that are looking at spreading it, and unless you guys correct me.
No, you're right. So that's the thing. Our numbers, well, just like Mike said, to me, they're impressive. I think they're pretty good. It works. But they're not even accounting for transmission to their family members, their friends outside university, their, you know, just everyone else. So I think it's tricky to just look at these absolute numbers and say, oh, it's only a 4% reduction. It's not so good.
Yeah, no, I agree. So in this case, it's not just simply looking at the evidence, period. It's there's a context that always has to go into it. And then we also have to go, well, what is the harm of it?
Yeah, and this is the when we talk about peer is based on that concept, right? Patients, mm-hmm. evidence, experience, and there's a rationality, as you're indicating, James, that goes behind this. And the rationale is, what's the harm? Very, mm-hmm. very little. What's the inconvenience? Very little. The evidence is suggesting this. It does help at least somewhat, and it may help much more than what we think, including the outside population. So it's a bit of a, you know, I can't understand what the objection is for the majority that are resisting this. Mm-hmm. I just can't understand. You've listed a few.
I do. I've been wearing masks for 4 or 5 months now. I can't feel my ears anymore. It's not funny.
No. Yeah, I mean, and there's no doubt that some people it irritates their face and so on. And I don't think there's any that is the harm.
I do have some colleagues who told me, well, it gives me acne on the face.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I get it, but just keep wearing your mask. We won't see it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so it's and like we're not saying that there's other things. There's a cost associated with them. There is if just walking around, people are discarding them everywhere. I mean, yeah. So I am not saying at all that they are without harm. Their harm is relatively minimal from that perspective. And you know, even in the last, I think, couple of days, I was going to say an idiot senator from the States, but I shouldn't say the word idiot. But he believed that he got COVID because he was wearing a face mask. So,
oh goodness,
I know. Yeah. And you kind of go, really? You know, he wasn't saying for sure, but he's saying, well, I didn't get it till I wore one. And you go, come on.
That's like saying I got a heart attack after I started a statin, so therefore statins cause
heart attacks. I know. It's the same. So, you know, I think this is, from a public health issue, this is very difficult. I'm glad I'm not having to make these decisions, because you're going to annoy a good, you know, chunk of the population no matter what you do. But I certainly think in places where there are outbreaks, I think a face mask probably should be mandatory, in my opinion. Here in BC, we have such a low risk of it. I think you can argue that that's probably not necessary. But I don't think you can argue that they don't work.
Yeah, I don't think so. And I don't, from what we know now, you mm-hmm. know, who knows, in another 10 years, there may be more research shows one way or the other. But right now, I think the evidence actually, and that's why I thought this systematic review is important, because we actually teased out where and how they do work and to what degree.
Yeah. So I would encourage people to go look at the simplified tool that we've created for this to sort of get a more of a grip on the numbers that we've just talked about, because there's so many nuances to it. It's not whether or not they work or not. You've got to go, well, how long were you wearing them? Over what period of time were you wearing them? Were you sick when you started to wear them? All sorts of different contexts. And so,
yeah. But you talked about statins just for a sec. The relative benefit of statins isn't that different from the relative benefit we saw in this.
Yeah.
Now the events are more serious, but still the relative effectiveness isn't that far off. And
yeah.
it's interesting when people look at this and go, well, it doesn't really work. Well, as a medical community, we say the statins work. So how can we, anyway, it makes me scratch my head a bit.
Yeah. So as best we could, by doing our own systematic review, and by say, when I say we, I mean primarily Nick and Mike, although I did help somewhat, that's the best we could come up with what randomized controlled trials show. We'll put links to the cohort studies that have been published recently to help people put those into context. And typically, as you see with cohort studies, is that they show a greater effect than randomized controlled trials. So it's not unexpected. But there, like we've said before, the evidence is that there is an effect. And, you know, when the risk is minimum, other than Nick can't feel his ears, and some people are getting a little bit of acne and stuff, there's not a ton of risks to wearing these. And I think from a societal perspective, it is not an unreasonable thing to ask people. I don't think it really has anything to do with the rights of individuals, at least the way I see it. Anything else you want to add, Mike or Nick?
Nothing for me, Nick.
Well, I would just add that as healthcare workers, we need to remind people that masks need to be worn in a certain way and manipulated in a certain way, because they probably don't work as well if they don't.
Yeah.
And masks are always just one small part of the whole prevention thing.
Absolutely. You know, there's, you know, social distancing. There's all, you know, all sorts of different things that people can do. There's even some studies on things like eye protection.
Mm-hmm.
And all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's just a small part of what one of the things that we can do to reduce the risk of transmission of viral illnesses. And at least now you know the best available evidence. So I think if there's nothing else, we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Bye.